Welcome to Physics and Religion, a series of podcasts exploring the significance of modern science to contemporary religion. I am your host, Dr. Albert Stets. We have been thinking about brains and computers. In the last lecture, I explained how neurons could be modeled with fairly simple linear algebra. Could we connect these mathematical neurons in such a way that they were conscious, in the same sense that we are conscious? I think the answer is no. But before I get around to telling you why, I would like to introduce you to two of the major players in the field of modern computing. I told you about Charles Babbage. The second giant in the field of computing and artificial intelligence was the Englishman Alan M. Turing. In the field of computer science, he has somewhat the same status as Einstein has in physics. He is the towering giant of the 20th century. During World War II, Turing was instrumental in cracking the extraordinarily complex code that the Nazi military used for most of its communications. The simplest code you can imagine is simply a set of rules for replacing one letter for another. For example, every time the letter T appears, replace it with a Q, replace U with B, and so forth. If your correspondent has a copy of the rules, he or she can easily translate the coded message. Unfortunately, your enemy can easily reconstruct the rules based on the frequency with which letters appear in English text. But suppose the rules change with each successive letter. It seems that would make the code impossible to break. The Nazis managed to write such a code with the help of a mechanical apparatus called the Enigma machine. This was an electromechanical rotor device that would change the code automatically. The sender would encode the message with an Enigma machine, and the recipient with another machine would decode it. With some of the more complicated Enigmas, there were billions of possible combinations. Even if you could review a million combinations a second, it would still take millions of years to decode any message, and the Nazis changed the machine settings every day. Part of the British success in breaking the code exploited regularities in the German communications. For example, they tended to end their messages with "Heil Hitler." There was also a weakness in the machine that it could never code a letter as itself. A major part of cracking the Enigma code made use of another machine built by Turing called the BOMB, that's spelled B-O-M-B-E. Which could sort possibilities with immense speed. Thanks to Turing's work, the Allies were able to decode almost all intercepted Nazi messages throughout the war. This had its downside. It forced some agonizing decisions. For example, the British knew that the city of Coventry was to be bombed, but they decided not to evacuate for fear of revealing the fact that the German messages were being decoded. Nonetheless, it could be argued that without Turing's genius, the Allies would have lost the war, or at least it would have continued much longer with great additional suffering on the part of the British people. The story does not have a happy ending. Turing was an atheist and a homosexual, and he was not discreet. Homosexual sodomy was treated as a crime in Britain in the 1950s. In the course of reporting a burglary in 1952, he made the mistake of informing the police of his homosexuality. He was arrested, tried, and convicted. As part of his sentence, he was to be subject to chemical castration. It seemed inevitable that his security clearance would be revoked and he would be subject to public humiliation. In June of 1954, he committed suicide by eating an apple dipped in cyanide. He was just 42 years old. For our purposes, Turing is notable for two other contributions, the Turing machine and the Turing test. The Turing machine is a sort of mathematician's abstract computer. No one would ever build a computer like it, but because of its extreme simplicity, it is possible to prove rigorous mathematical theorems about what computers can and cannot do. The machine consists of an infinitely long tape marked off in squares, on which are written symbols like 1 and 0, and a read head that can read, erase, and write symbols and move the tape one square to the right or left. The read head contains a set of instructions of the form. For example, if the head is in state 17 and the square contains a 1, change to state 43 and move the tape 1 square to the right. Or again, another example, if the head is in state 78 and the square contains a 0, replace it with a 1 and move the tape 1 square to the left. Nowadays, we would say that the tape was data and the instructions in the read head were the program. Turing was able to prove that any calculation that could be performed on any computer could be done by this simple machine. He also noted that there are calculations that seem quite trivial to humans, but which cannot be done by any computer. This last point is worth some careful thought. Computer operations are said to be algorithmic. That is to say, the computer's calculations are always done according to a list of instructions. When we are performing operations in our head that are impossible for any computer, we are thinking non-algorithmically. It has been claimed, and also denied, that our minds are ultimately not computers, and that computers will never be able to think like us because we are capable of non-algorithmic thought. Turing himself didn't think so. He claimed that mathematical arguments are no help in deciding if a machine can think. He proposed instead an experimental test, which he called the imitation game, and which has come to be known as the Turing test. Imagine that you are communicating with either a computer or another human being through a computer terminal. You submit questions and the unknown entity replies. Your job is to decide whether you are communicating with a person or a computer, and of course, the computer doesn't have to tell the truth. So, for example, if you ask the computer, "Are you a computer?" it will reply, "No." An intelligent computer, claimed Turing, is one that can systematically fool the human questioner. The implication is that this is the only meaningful way to define intelligence. So, how well are we doing in building such a computer? There is a contest held every year called the Loebner Prize. That's spelled L-O-E-B-N-E-R. Contestants submit their computer programs, which are questioned by a panel of 12 judges. If you can fool the majority of judges for 5 minutes, you win $100,000 and a gold medal. No one ever has. There's actually a website where you can go and interview some of the best programs from past competitions. If you'd like to play the imitation game, just type into Google Loebner Prize. The Turing machine is an example of algorithmic computing. That is to say, it operates according to a definite set of instructions. The instructions are contained in the read heads and are put there by people who build the computer. Another way to look at this is that the Turing machine works by manipulating symbols, in this case the symbols 1 and 0. All von Neumann-style computers are symbol manipulators. The symbols now are represented by 32 or 64-bit words, but they are symbols nevertheless. In the early days of AI, it was assumed that intelligence could be reduced to symbol manipulation. And this approach has come to be called good old-fashioned artificial intelligence, or GoFi for short. This approach had some notable successes early on. Programs were developed that could prove theorems in logic, mathematics, and geometry, and play decent games of backgammon, checkers, and chess. In retrospect, these tasks are most easily represented by symbols. Other tasks, face recognition, for example, proved to be much more difficult. The other aspects of intelligence, like pattern recognition, context sensitivity, and rough-and-ready categorization, proved much more difficult. It became increasingly clear how few human abilities actually fit the GoFi model. Certainly, the brain in no way resembles a von Neumann computer. The brain does parallel processing on a massive scale, and it does it with neurons. So why not model a computer like the brain? Thus was born the idea of neural nets. Connectionism and parallel processing are more or less synonymous terms for this. The header of this podcast is a very schematic diagram of a simple neural net. The circles represent neurons, and lines connecting them are a combination of an axon from the previous neuron, a synapse, and a dendrite leading into the next neuron. Associated with each synapse is a weight. This is a small number which might be positive or negative. In this diagram, we can simply say that the weight is associated with the entire line. The weights can be adjusted, and in this way, the network learns, shall we say, from experience. From the point of view of mathematics, a neuron is just a function called the activation function. It simply adds up the incoming signals, and depending upon how large the sum is, it produces some output that is fed onto the next neuron. Suppose we want to teach a network to recognize faces. First, we digitize some photos so that they can be fed into the net. We know the names of these people, of course, and the network has a list of possible names. We choose a sample of photos called the training set and feed them into the net. The net has never seen these people before, and so its responses are just wild guesses. We now change the weights so that it makes better guesses. Feed the training set in again and again, adjust the weights. We might have to do this many times until the network is completely trained. How well does this work? Here's an example in some detail. Garrison Cottrell and his group at UC San Diego constructed a three-layer neural net that used photos as input. The training set consisted of 64 photos of 11 different faces with different expressions, plus 13 photos of none faces, photos of a watch or a bulletin board, for example. Once trained, the machine achieved 100% accuracy in the training sample. It could tell you which was a face, what the sex of the person was, and who it was. The team then showed the computer many pictures of the same people, but with different expressions. It was 98% accurate at identifying the name and gender of the new photos. The team then showed the net more pictures of people it had never seen. It was still 100% accurate in distinguishing between faces and non-faces, and 81% accurate in determining the sex of these people. I think that if you showed me photos of faces of students on campus, I would not do much better myself. There are some things about this I find fascinating. If you were to stop your desktop computer in the midst of a calculation and peer into its CPU, you could discern exactly what it was doing. Look into its program memory and you will learn what it is going to do. Look into its hard drive and you will see the data it is working with. But with a neural net, you never know what it is thinking about. The result of all its knowledge and judgment is a set of apparently meaningless numbers. This brings me around to the question I started with. Is the mind nothing more than a large computer? We know now that it is certainly not a von Neumann-style computer, but might it be just a very large neural net? It is certainly true that we can model or instantiate various mental processes or sub-processes with artificial neural nets. It is also true that when we think about something, various areas of our brains light up in functional MRI scans. To use a technical term, there are neural correlates to our thoughts. But is that the whole story? People working in computer science will often say glibly, "Yes, of course, that's all there is." Philosophers are not so sure. When philosophers argue the issue, it is usually with the help of some bizarre thought experiments. The most famous of these is called the Chinese Room Argument, first proposed by John Searle of UC Berkeley. Let's assume that you don't know any Chinese, but you are in a room with many instruction books written in English and Chinese. Chinese speakers pass questions into you written in their native language. You then consult your reference books as to how you are going to answer. They say things like, if you see the following set of meaningless symbols, reply with this set of equally meaningless symbols. You pass your responses on to the Chinese speakers outside, and they assume you are also a native speaker, but in fact, you understood absolutely nothing you wrote. Searle's point is that in the room, you are doing exactly what a computer does. You are taking input data and processing it according to a set of instructions, but without any understanding of what you are doing. The input, the output, and the instructions are all meaningless. Searle makes the following distinction. Syntax refers to the rules for making grammatical sentences. Semantics refers to the meaning of these sentences. Computers are masters of syntax. They know all the rules, but they know nothing of semantics. It would be trivially wrong to say that our minds are not computers. We can compute, after all. But our minds are not only computers. We have semantics. They don't. Searle makes a further point that seems to me very important. Suppose you are typing a letter using MS Word. You are communicating with the computer by means of electrical impulses. The computer responds by putting little black patterns on your monitor screen. Searle's point is that neither the electrical impulses nor the letters on the screen by themselves have any meaning. The meaning is intrinsic to you, not the computer. Paper money makes a good analogy. Think of a $100 bill. It's just a piece of paper. In and of itself, it is practically worthless. We assign it meaning and value. There have been numerous attempts to refute this argument. Perhaps the best we can do by way of a refutation is to say that Searle's argument is based on our current knowledge of computers and consciousness. Perhaps one day we will see all this from a larger perspective. Perhaps. I would not want to discourage further research in computers as means of understanding the mind, but there are further philosophical considerations that I will take up in the next podcast.